Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Right now, we're going to head out to Davidson, North Carolina, cover some of the day's COVID headlines, which includes deaths in Europe from COVID-19, expected to reach 2.2 million by March based on current trends. That's coming from the World Health Organization, putting out a warning as they also push for more vaccination. Meantime, Germany's top health official reiterated that the country cannot rule out any measures to contain the fourth wave. So let's get to it with Dr. Dave Westner, professor of biology at Davidson College, on the phone from Davidson, North Carolina. Dr. Westner, nice to have you here with Ed Ludlow and myself. So when you see the day's headlines, you watch what's going on in Europe, I kind of ask all of our guests, is what's going on in Europe going to happen here in the United States? Can we make that assumption?
I think we can. Thanks for having me back again. I think we're already starting to see cases go up throughout the United States. We're seeing deaths go up at a lesser rate, but deaths going up also. So, yeah, I think that what's happening in Europe now very well could be what we see over the next few months here.
Dr. Westner, do you get any sense that American officials are sort of complacent? You know, you had Jeff Zients from the White House saying that, you know, we have vaccines, we have boosters, we have the therapeutics if we need them. You won't see what's happening in Europe happen here. Why won't we see it happen here?
Well, I think they have the vaccines. They have those interventions available in Europe as well. I think that's a myopic way of looking at it. Yes, we have the vaccines. We have the boosters that we're rolling out. But all the data suggests that we're going to see the same kind of increase here that we're seeing elsewhere.
Well, and it's interesting. I guess we all have to figure out as we go, make our way through at this point. It's funny, I saw something I was reading in this morning, Dr. Westner, and it's like, well, wait a minute, if you're 6 months out from your second vaccine, does that mean you're not vaccinated anymore? Are you not protected?
Yeah, I think we should be clear about that. I mean, these vaccines are really good vaccines. If you go back to a year ago, a year and a half ago, a lot of people were saying if we had a vaccine that was 60 or 70% effective, that would be a win. And we got a couple of vaccines that are 90 and 95% effective, much better than anyone anticipated initially. You know, the waning immunity that we're seeing with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are certainly a concern. But even 6 months out, we're seeing vaccines that are 70% effective. So it's certainly not the case that 6 months after your second shot, you're functionally unvaccinated. Mm-hmm. There's still, even without the booster, there's still a good deal of protection 6 months out.
I wonder if there's a weak spot, though, right? Is it if you're part of the unvaccinated portion of society that you're most at risk? Is it that, broadly, we should all still be wearing masks?
I think that's, I guess, broadly is a sort of iffy term. I think under certain circumstances, yes, masks should still be worn. If you're in a crowded indoor setting, it's probably a good idea to have a mask on, even if you have both the two jabs, and you've gotten that booster shot recently. You know, I think we're at a point now where, yes, we have a lot of interventions that are decreasing severe disease, decreasing hospitalization, decreasing deaths, but we're not out of the woods, and we shouldn't assume that we are out of the woods just yet.
And what about mixing and matching? The CDC's recommendations allow, I guess, right, for mix and match dosing for booster shots. And certainly, I think it's safe to say that many of coming off the J&J one suggest, you get Pfizer and Moderna. What's your guidance on that or your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's no evidence to suggest that mixing and matching is a bad thing. We've seen nothing indicating that if you had two Pfizer shots initially, the Moderna shot is going to be disadvantageous in any way. It appears that mixing and matching is perfectly reasonable. In either case, if you have the same booster as your original two shots, or if you have one of the others, immunity goes up dramatically within a week or two of that booster shot. So there doesn't seem to be any downside to mixing and matching the vaccines.
Dr. Westner, I'm always curious, you teach biology. I love biology. If I wasn't doing this, I might be a doctor. That was something that was certainly on my radar. But I do wonder how teaching of biology and against a backdrop of the pandemic and the creating of a vaccine, how it's changed or what's the interaction with students? What do students want to know and understand?
It's been really interesting for me in that role because, we can talk about biology with a real life example that's playing mm-hmm. out in real time, which has really been fascinating. And I think it makes the topic that much more real in both the biology we're learning in class and the biology that's happening in the real world. It makes it more real, more understandable, I guess. So yeah, that's really been an interesting situation to talk about something that's happening in real time as we're discussing it.
Well, Carol makes a good point, which is education, essentially, right? In general population, do people understand the science behind the vaccine? Have they spent the time researching the reasons for taking or whether to wear a mask or not? Are you just kind of concerned that people don't take COVID seriously enough?
I think a lot of people don't. I think a lot of people, will say anecdotally, well, I had a friend who was sick for a couple of days, but that was it. So I think there has been this attitude among a segment of the population that it's something that we don't have to really take that seriously. But if you look at the numbers, you all can think back to the big surge in New York. I mean, it was the healthcare system was overwhelmed. And we could get to that point again. I think it's a very serious disease. It's much more transmissible than the typical influenza virus is. It's a much more serious illness than we see typically with influenza. I think we have to remember that this is a very serious infectious disease, and we can't forget that at this point in time.
Yeah, I got to say, in terms of mask wearing, I feel like I will wear one forever. just because it's interesting in terms of just basic colds and things. I've seen more people getting sick as things have eased, and it was really nice to go through a full year and not even have a common cold.
Yeah, if you look at the flu season last year, I mean, flu was almost non-existent throughout the United States, and a large part of that was because we weren't gathering. There weren't large groups of people indoors. People were wearing masks when they were out. And just generally, those precautions are going to prevent the transmission of respiratory diseases. This year, as you noted, Carol, we're seeing more cases of flu, certainly,
right,
than we have the past couple of years. And to a large extent, it's that's because people are gathering more, people are out more, people aren't wearing masks like they would in the past. So maybe things will change permanently after this. I mean, we've seen that before with infectious diseases, that things change permanently. And maybe some aspect of mask wearing or limiting gatherings will be a permanent change.
Hey, listen, I wanted to share with you a frequent listener and watcher of our show on YouTube shared with me a story. Ryan, thank you. And just took a look at what's going on in Michigan right now. The Henry Ford Health System has seen COVID-19 cases soar by 50% in 3 weeks, putting a major strain on staff and patients at the Detroit-based network of five major hospitals in southeast Michigan. It's the latest U.S. hotspot, 7-day case rate of more than 600 per 100,000. That's triple the national average. And so we see this, we often talk about this being a disease of the unvaccinated. What do we finally do to get the unvaccinated to believe the message, in your view?
That's a really good question. And there's going to be some fraction of the population that you're not going to reach. I think that's becoming clear. But I think, getting back to Ed's point earlier, I mean, education is key. We have to get the word out that these vaccines are safe. They've gone through clinical trials. They're extremely effective. And not have people get lost in the noise of, oh, you know, immunity wanes over time, so I shouldn't get a vaccine. I think we have to get that word out to that segment of the population.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so let's get to it. Let's see what Dr. Ellen Wald has to say. She's back with us, president of Transversal Consulting, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center. She wrote the book Saudi Inc. on the history of Aramco in Saudi Arabia. And she has also been a Bloomberg Opinion contributor. She's back with us from Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Ellen, so nice to have you here. I have to ask you about a couple of things the president said. He said that he's making the largest ever release from the SPR, will provide the supply that we need. Will it, and will it make a difference?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because part of the issue is, do we really need more supply? Is the reason why prices are higher really due to a lack of supply? And it doesn't seem like anyone is having trouble getting gasoline or getting crude oil. So it's not clear that the issue is really one of supply. Perhaps the release will have an effect on the market and will encourage the market to lower prices, although we haven't seen that happening yet. The biggest drop in oil prices actually happened last week, in reaction really to the announcement that we were going to see more COVID lockdowns in Europe. Today, actually, prices rose in response to the SPR release. So
Why are prices up when we do this release? It's been a little bit of a conundrum today, I feel like.
Yeah, well, I think it has to do a lot with market perceptions, because this release has been telegraphed, and a lot of people were basically waiting to see, okay, how much is it going to be, and what other nations were going to be involved in this coordinated release, and it's possible that what was announced was not nearly as significant as the market was hoping for, and so that's why we're seeing this price reaction.
Yeah, choreographed, as you said, Ellen Wald, telegraphed almost because of that curious reaction in the market. You remember when something like this happens, how deeply political the oil market is, you know, how sensitive it is domestically for voters. But also, one thing we haven't talked about yet is OPEC Plus. You know, they could easily turn around and change their existing plan in terms of their supply into the market. What should we be looking for with OPEC Plus?
Oh, absolutely. And gasoline prices are always something that's political, especially in the U.S. Consumers always seem to connect higher gasoline prices with the administration that's in office, and tend to blame that administration, regardless of whether they have any role over it at all. So it's definitely a political issue in the United States. When it comes to OPEC Plus, though, it's very interesting, because the amount that is being released, or the amount that has that we've heard is being released, we still haven't heard from China and South Korea if they're going to be making any releases, is about as much as 3 months of the supply that OPEC would be increasing. So OPEC has been increasing its production by 400,000 barrels a day for several months now, and plans to continue that. The interesting twist, though, is that OPEC is supposed to meet next week on Thursday to decide if they're going to continue their increases for January. So some people think that this could potentially throw OPEC kind of for a loop, and will OPEC decide maybe they want to rein it back in? I think that OPEC is really going to be looking at the market overall. They're going to be looking at, are oil stockpiles starting to build as opposed to being drawn down? And they will probably look pretty carefully at what's going on in China and what Chinese industrial production is like and Chinese demand is like. They don't make their decisions just based off of gasoline prices in the U.S.
But Ellen, if it's not a supply issue, then what's going on? And the president talked about taking some action on gasoline prices, unacceptable for gas firms to pocket gains, that gap between wholesale and retail gas prices. Is there something fishy going on? Just got about 45 seconds or so. Yeah.
Yeah. It really doesn't appear to be. Remember, there's more that goes into gasoline than just wholesale gasoline prices. There's the price of ethanol, which has gone up. There are the price of other additives, which has gone up. And there's just general inflation. Plus, there's just the price of oil, which has gone up. So there's a lot that goes into this, and it doesn't necessarily mean that there's some kind of anti-competitive, collusive behavior going on.
And also, as Ed pointed out, there he is in London, right? It's expensive. We're seeing it as well. This is a, just quickly, Ellen, it's a global issue. It's not just a U.S. issue.
Yeah, it's definitely a global issue. And in some areas, it's even more pronounced. U.S. Gasoline prices in the U.S. are traditionally much lower than elsewhere in the world. So part of it's also taxes. A lot of states have increased their gasoline taxes over recent years.
Some really great perspective. Ellen, we knew when we saw the story we wanted to reach out to you. So thank you so much. Have a great and safe Thanksgiving. Dr. Ellen Wald, she's president of Transversal Consulting. Check out her book, Saudi Inc., that deals with Saudi Arabia and Aramco.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So climate change, we know what it's done. It's created flooding, droughts, unusual weather patterns, and wildfires. It's a story, and there's actually a story that digs into this. It can be found at businessweek.com. It looks at how wildfires are getting worse and the one company that has all the chemicals to combat them. That story written by Bloomberg News technology reporter Austin Carr. He's on the phone in Boston. And also joining us, Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber. He's in our Interactive Brokers studio. A company I hadn't heard about.
And yet, it publicly traded and is sort of in a solutions business. Where, of all the places that we're probably desperate for solutions, it's with wildfires, which seem to only be getting worse. And here we are in November, and California still is at peak wildfire fears. And so Austin, like, tell us what exactly this company Perimeter Solutions is up to.
Sure. Yeah. So you've probably seen on the news during big wildfires, all these planes that are making humongous drops of all that red stuff. That's all retardant made by this one single retardant maker, the biggest one in the U.S., called Perimeter Solutions. And just to give it some context, they actually, for U.S. agencies alone, produced about 50 million gallons of their retardants last year. With the fire season booming, the retardants business is booming as well. And that's why just 2 weeks ago they went public at a valuation of about $2 billion. So for this story for Business Week, we spent a lot of time learning about this sole source contractor for the federal government, how they got so big in the retardants business, and a new Stanford-engineered chemical that they're putting out that it might end up changing the game for how we address wildfires in the country.
Tell us more.
So the product that you see dropped out of planes is called PhosCheck, and it basically boxes all the fires in, but it's not as effective after it rains a small amount or when there are tons of high winds. It usually actually goes away, and it's not effective after a couple weeks. And at that point, like you've seen in California, another big fire can just happen again. On the other hand, they have this new chemical called Fortify, which again was engineered by Stanford scientists, and it's this white gel that's applied before the wildfire season and sticks on places where there are really high risks of ignitions. We actually have tons of data about where fires originate because we happen to have a lot of wildfires now in the U.S. and in places like vegetation around utility poles or highways or railroad tracks. We can apply this solution now, this chemical gel that will last for months and ideally prevent those fires from happening. As one Perimeter executive told me, he had said that we'd rather be fighting wildfires when they're just 4 inches tall rather than 40 feet tall. And I think that's the promise that Perimeter is trying to pitch the government on going forward.
And Ludlow, you're in London right now, but California's your home. You've seen this.
Yeah, this story really hit home for me. I enjoyed reading it, not just because of the product. You know, I've experienced the fires and the side effects of the fires, but the great thing about your story is you talk about the people that are using the product, the farmers, you know, the wine growers in Napa Valley. But it seems like this company is the only product in town. Is this thing affordable? Is it, you know, is this something that everyday landowners can actually get hold of?
it is something that landowners can get a hold of, but I mean, it's really a product that it's going to take some time to get adoption, and I think the larger market is actually utility giants like PG&E or insurance companies or railroad companies that, you know, they'd rather maybe spend a few million dollars upfront on this product rather than billions of dollars in liabilities later on. But in this story, we did interview one local community that had used it, and for 1 mile stretch, it cost about $30,000. Obviously, that's an expensive application, but when we talked to local fire departments, what they said is we'd love to use more of it. I talked to one near San Diego that had seen huge ignitions go from a few dozen in the last couple years down to zero after they applied the product. But what they basically said is we'd love to use more of it. We just can't afford it.
So Austin, what other products are they? I mean, this company just went public. I mean, do they have two products? Do they have more? What's in development? Like, and exactly how competitive of a space is this at this point, since this problem seems to only get worse and worse?
So they do, this company Perimeter Solutions does make a ton of different retardants, whether they're gels or foams or powder or liquid concentrations, and they all have different uses by the fire department or private companies and homeowners. But to be honest, they're really the only game in town. I mean, just to give you a sense, they about half, 58% or so of their fire safety products are consumed by the U.S. government in the state of California alone. They're pretty much a virtual monopoly, and that's one of the big criticisms. They're the only approved federally approved product that the U.S. Forest uses for aerial drops, those big planes. And I only talked to one competitor, and the issue that they said is it takes so many years to get on that retardants list to be approved that it is very advantageous for Perimeter Solutions and their primary flagship product, which is that red stuff that drops out of planes. And so we haven't seen much competition. It costs about $3 a gallon for that stuff they drop out of plane. And so far, they continue to be the sole source provider to the U.S. government and have been for almost 2 decades.
All right, I got to ask you, if you're going to end up spraying my vegetables and stuff, is it safe?
It's a really good question, Carol, and there is a lot of environmental concerns. I will also say just it's kind of very odd to watch. I went to air bases. I've seen this stuff sprayed in person, and whether it's the red stuff dropping from planes or the new white chemical Fortify, to just see it doused all over the planet, it's pretty eye-opening. And when I talk to the company, they say, look, the stuff that's in here is ammonium phosphate, which is the same stuff that's used in fertilizers. So it actually might make your garden grow a little bit faster. But the downside of it is that it can. Studies have shown that it's if it's dropped in water areas, it can kill fish. It can also spurn algae blooms and invasive plants that can be disruptive to the natural environment. But the larger truth is there just haven't been enough studies, which is kind of wild. They said in their S-1 statement when they
went
public.
That's what I call a wait what moment?
They said in their S-1 statement that the current environmental impact is just not known. There's not enough known about it because it could have larger toxicity impact on the environment or the animal population, but there have just been a lack of studies over the years and they've been limited in scope. And so the U.S. government continues to drop tens of millions of gallons on the planet, just in America, and it's become popular worldwide. And so there's a lot of questions about environmental impact that still have to be answered.
So most important question of all, from the photos in the story, it looks like there's a vehicle. This is on a trailer. They spray it from the back of the trailer. Did you get to spray the gel?
You know, I'm not approved yet by the California Fire Department, although I did go through the chemical retardant mixing. I did get my diploma, Joel, so you'll be happy to hear. We can add that to my my Twitter page, but and maybe our Mass Head of Business
Week. Does that go before or after a daiquiri specialist?
Daiquiri specialist comes first, as always.
Nice to know if the journalism doesn't work out. You've got all these other things that you can fall back on, Austin. Incredible read, a lot of information in there, and check it out at Bloomberg.com. Happy Thanksgiving to you and to you as well, Joel. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, and of course, Austin Carr, technology reporter and a man of many talents here at Bloomberg News. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic.
from Bloomberg Radio.
So we just talked about Best Buy shares plummeting, and we're going to get into that a little bit. We also see Dollar Tree selling the majority of its products for more than a buck now. There's a lot going on when it comes to retail. And then, of course, there are those supply chain woes that we continually talk about. Lots going on, as I mentioned. Our Bloomberg Intelligence senior analyst, Poonam Goyal, keeping track of it all and writing, even with those supply constraints, Americans, they're going to be out there shopping this holiday season. She joins Ed and me on the phone in New Jersey. Poonam, good to have you here. First up, before we get into the holiday season, any thoughts on Best Buy? I know you cover a lot of different retail. And this maybe doesn't fall right under some of the companies that you follow, but those criminal groups, like, I can't, you know, it's very odd to have a CEO come out and talk about that, right?
It is. You know, it must be a really big problem for them to come out and say that. But it's a scary one because not only is it bad for them on the margin side, but it prevents people from wanting to go to the stores, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're hesitant about what you'll have to deal with should you go into the stores. And the employees working there must be scared to want to work there. So it has a lot of different effects.
You have to remember what Best Buy does as well. I wish we'd discussed this a moment ago, Carol, but they sell things that we really needed in the pandemic. And we're not buying as much of right now, you know, screens, electronics, all this kind of stuff. It's kind of like a 1-2 punch. I feel bad for them. I guess, Poonam, you know, broadly, is demand really good right now, you know, for Best Buy electronics, for brick and mortar?
Well, demand is good overall in retail. And we've seen that in the retail sales numbers leading up to as recent as, you know, recent earnings results that we've seen from the retailers. That said, electronic sales, computers, TVs, and all of that, you have to remember, we're lapping the pandemic, right, when there was mostly at-home learning for schools. Now kids are back in school, so the demand has tapered from last year's levels, but it's still higher than it was in 2019.
No, that's a really good point. I have to say, even though on my street I've seen some boxes for people who have obviously just gone out and bought a huge screen TV at this point. The other thing is Best Buy did talk about spending more on promotional activity, and that really hit into gross margin. All right, so let's talk, Poonam, about retail shopping. I know my daughter's already given me her holiday list. It's a little bit toned down, which is kind of nice to see that from your kids. Tell us, though, why it's going to be off the charts. Is it because of higher prices, or are we going to actually be selling more stuff?
It's going to be a combination of both. So demand is higher, especially for categories like apparel and toys, where kids are going out more and people are going out more, so they want new things. On the sales side, the reason why we're expecting for high single digit or even better gains is in part due to higher prices. Yes, prices will be higher because of inflationary pressures, but also discounting will be lower. So while there will be discounts over the coming days and even through Christmas, they won't be as pronounced as they were in past years.
Should we put everyone in a bad mood and talk about supply chains? I mean, is my favorite sweater going to be on the shelf this holiday season? The things that I want, are they actually going to be there?
They will, but how long they'll be there is the bigger question. And that's why retailers...
tell us more.
Everyone. Yeah, so get what you want now.
Well, it's funny that you say that, too. Go ahead, Ed, please.
Well, I was just going to say that in your I'm being cheeky, but in your research, you point out pretty clearly, right, that the holiday season shopping window is long this year. You know, everyone is going to have every opportunity to go out. You know, why would that give us a boost?
Because you get an extra shopping day. So if you look at the time frame from when people really, you know, spend the most time buying gifts and thinking about the holidays, it's between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And this year, the calendar lends itself one extra day. So an extra day is always an extra shopping day, means extra dollars for the retailers.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It makes a difference. I know that there's been a time where I've really kind of finished my shopping, and then all of a sudden I go out because I have an extra day and I pick up a couple of little things. What's interesting is, so who's going to benefit the most? You talk about Walmart and Amazon in your recent note. What's interesting is we just talked with our Augusta Sariva, who's looking at the global supply chain, and she's pointing out how everything's going wrong at the same time. And yet, you know, there's companies like Amazon that can find alternatives to getting their goods here. Walmart can do the same thing, right? Whether they reach out to different suppliers or use their own logistical chains to some extent, they've got deep pockets to be able to do so.
You're absolutely right on that. You know, the way we simplified is the bigger, the better this holiday. So the big retailers really have a competitive edge because they can afford to pay more to get the goods here. And that, and also in addition to that, Walmart and Amazon specifically don't have an inventory issue right now. Walmart's inventories were up about 11% at the end of the third quarter. So they've been able to bring goods in. The other thing is they have a large third-party marketplace, both of them. And that helps flow inventory, at least online, for both retailers.
And very quickly, Poonam, I mean, foot traffic seems to be pretty good, though, doesn't it? Isn't it strong, the number of people actually going into a store? Are they just excited to be shopping in person?
It is strong when you look at it versus last year, but the numbers that we're looking at right against 2019, it's actually still down.
Interesting, too. But you also point out an influx of tourists into the U.S. over the coming weeks could drive at least a high single-digit retail sales gain over the holiday period. So it's interesting. A lot of different factors at play. Poonam, always good to get a gut check on what's going on in retail, especially as we head into the all-important holiday shopping season. She is senior analyst for e-commerce, athleisure, off-price retail. That means TJ Maxx, which I always love. Ed Ludlow, do you go to TJ Maxx?
Oh, I do.
I'm driving in my car.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no. This is not a toy.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just got about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. We are driving to the close. We're definitely off our best levels of the session, although I should say for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, kind of hovering just off of it, but certainly a little bit different when it comes to the S&P and the NASDAQ. Let's talk about the market trade today. Megan Horniman is Director of Portfolio Strategy at the wealth advisory and multifamily office firm Verdins Capital Advisors. She's back with us on the phone from Hunt Valley, Maryland. So, Megan, nice to have you here. Just a few days away from Thanksgiving. We're talking inflation. We're talking about supply chains. We're talking about a release from the SPR. What is top of mind for you and your clients?
So I think it's going into year end and, you know, what's going to happen with the rally here. That's, I think, one of the biggest concerns for investors, especially since we're starting to see this back up in interest rates. And we have seen that, you know, historically when we see these kinds of moves in interest rates, it does challenge the equity market. We're seeing that today with specifically those expensive tech names, as well as seeing the volatility index increase today.
The other big news items of the week, of course, the nomination to the Federal Reserve. And I know that you wrote going into the week that you felt Biden would keep a relatively dovish FOMC because he wanted to help his spending agenda, right? How do you think about things now?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously, yes, he wanted to have two things as someone who's viewed as a relative dove in the market because of the fact that he does have a very aggressive spending agenda. And if you just look at estimates for, you know, the net interest costs for the government over the next decade, they are exposed to skyrocket. So it presents a problem for any of his priorities. But Powell has also kind of been a little bit more towards the center in knowing that we do have some inflationary pressures that need to be addressed. So you see the market now pricing in the potential for two rate hikes in the second half of next year. So I think that the other thing that markets like is just the continuity. You know, having someone new, markets have never really liked that. So having Powell at the helm again, I think, is keeps that, you know, nerves from unrattling.
Megan, what's the constructive conversation to have around interest rates right now? I mean, we did see, you know, another pop up right in the 10-year today, and we are seeing certainly coming off of that Fed nomination. However, it's still a long time from here until, let's say, mid-year of next year when we'll see the Fed easing off, right, in terms of those asset purchases. But easing off does not necessarily automatically guarantee an interest rate hike, especially as we watch kind of what's going on around the globe. If China slows down, there could be some other issues. If the pandemic continues to weigh on the economy, maybe all bets are off.
Yes, there's a lot of moving parts there that you've outlined. And I think the one thing that we believe is that interest rates right now where they are do not justify not only the economic environment, but also the inflation environment. So we do think the trajectory is higher for interest rates next year. However, all those things that you mentioned are some of the reasons why we don't think you're going to see, you know, a massive spike in interest rates over the next 12 months. We still do have a lot of uncertainty around the supply chain disruption. We have a lot of uncertainty around the labor market. We also have some uncertainty around how sustainable this consumer can be in the face of rising prices at the pump, rising prices on everyday necessities. Can we continue into 2022 to see the sustainability of this consumer? So you're going to have a little give and take, I think, in the interest rate market. But at the end of the day, the Fed is very warranted to taper. It was an emergency measure. We're no longer in an emergency situation. And I think that the next phase for them is to gradually try and normalize interest rates. So we're still calling for that in the second half of next year.
I wanted to ask you about the consumer, not just in the context of inflation. How closely are you following the data around COVID-19, particularly in Europe? You have Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, all saying that the kind of spikes we're seeing in Europe, they'll be temporary. And they don't necessarily think that it'll come over to the United States by the reopening trade. Is that the way you think about it?
Yeah, because we've seen spikes and, you know, you have some short-term kind of reversal in that reopening trade, but then they do tend to peak and moderate lower. It's just we don't know when. And I have seen the data out of Europe, specifically in Germany. It's actually eye-popping if you look at the chart and what they're dealing with right now. But keep in mind that we are moving closer and closer, getting more and more people vaccinated. That's a positive. But the biggest part of COVID that we're going to look at into 2022 is the approval of some more therapeutics, because those hesitant to get a vaccine, which is everybody's own personal decision, if there's a therapeutic that's out there that can reduce the risk of serious infection, that's almost as good as the vaccine when it comes to the risks and strain we put on the hospitals. And that's what we're concerned about right now in Europe.
You know, it's interesting, too. And you guys deal with high net wealth individuals. And I do wonder, you know, we talked about the initial part of the conversation about some of the things that everybody's talking about, whether it's inflation or supply chain constraints. What would you say is their number one concern right now? Because many of these, right, many, it is inflation. Okay. Because many of these individuals have gotten wealthier, right? Safe to say over the last year or two.
Yeah, absolutely. I still think it's inflation. I can give you the second biggest concern for our high net worth individuals. But inflation's the biggest one because it's now visible across so many aspects of the economy. You know, before, when it was just lumber prices or it was just food or, you know, and some of the COVID related things, That we could say some of that was transitory, but people don't. The one thing people will remember and realize right away is at the gas pump, and we've seen more than a dollar increase year to date in gasoline prices. That's a big hit to consumer budgets. So that's going to be felt by all consumers, high net worth or not. The second biggest thing would be what will happen with taxes. And the one thing we do know is that we don't think taxes are going to go any lower. It's just what magnitude will that hit high net worth individuals as well as business owners.
How worried or not are we about Biden's commitment with infrastructure? How worried or not are we about what the president was saying today about his, you know, efforts in the supply chain? We were speaking to a Bloomberg News colleague a little earlier this hour that all of the bottlenecks in global supply chains that he was saying are working to be undone, they're still there. You know, what is going to be the impact of fiscal policy and government stimulus over the next year or so?
So the infrastructure's done. There's nothing we can do about that. But over the next year, you know, this is going to be more of an impact into GDP in the longer run, not necessarily, for example, for next year. But when you're talking about so much money chasing so few goods because the supply chain is disrupted right now, then it, you know, any additional spending is really not needed. And the only thing that is going to fix the supply chain disruptions and some of these kind of interconnected inflation pressures is either a slowdown in demand or an increase in supply. And we know that there will be an increase in supply. It's just not something that's going to turnover overnight. I mean, we just understand that there's a lot of ships sitting out to port. There are some disruptions, but with so many different facets of the supply chain that can't be fixed right away, it's going to take time to fix that. So we need to see some moderation in the demand side. So any additional spending from the government that adds to the pent-up demand from the American consumer, it's just that is a concern and a risk that we see.
Hey, Megan, just got about 25, 30 seconds here. Just quickly, what's one number one investment that many of your clients tend to ask about?
You know, they always want to know about the equity market and can we continue with this bull market? We do think that is the case, but we would allocate outside of the U.S. as well, because I think next year, 2022, there could be some rotation there. You know, I don't think the U.S. is going to deliver the same types of returns. And then trying to find some, you know, attractively valued inflation hedges, we would lean more towards the infrastructure. You know, there's lots of different investments right out there in the infrastructure front that we think will kind of, they're structured to help you with that as well.
All right. Great to get that in. Thanks so much. Have a great Thanksgiving. Megan Horniman, she's Director of Portfolio Strategy at Verdins Capital Advisors, joining us on the phone from Hunt Valley, Maryland.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.